Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Usually, when we begin peeling back the layers on a modern cultural icon, we expect to find a story rooted in early business attempts.
Right. Maybe a founder's quirky relative, or just a charming, if slightly dusty, piece of history.
Exactly. We follow the threads, and we usually end up with something that explains why this symbol became so familiar, so comforting.
But not this time. Today, we are fulfilling a specific request from a listener who provided us with this, well, this unnerving collection of source material.
Unnerving is the word for it. These are records that suggest one of the world's most recognizable symbols of childhood joy has roots not in marketing genius,
but in unsolved tragedy, and a very meticulous erasure of that tragedy.
So we are diving deep into the alleged origins of Ronald McDonald. And the story we're unpacking today, it just flips the entire script.
It really does. Our mission here is to take these sources, which detail this specific, eerie, and I have to say, profoundly dark legend from the late 1890s Midwest, and trace its purported echo.
An echo into the world of 20th century corporate branding. The sources almost read like a true crime file, don't they?
They do. So we're going to analyze the myth as if it were historical fact, just to understand its power, you know, as a piece of cultural critique.
And if we had to give you the one-line takeaway, the thing you need to hold on to as we get started, it's this.
Sometimes the scariest mascots don't start as marketing concepts engineered for familiarity. They start as the central figure in a series of unsolved missing persons reports.
The source material we have is, it's startlingly precise. It chronicles the physical description of the man, the operational logistics of his bizarre traveling show.
The outcome of the local investigations, or lack thereof.
And then, years later, this incredibly unsettling collision with a burgeoning fast food empire, we are going to treat this narrative structure with the rigor it really deserves, dissecting all of its thematic elements.
To truly absorb the weight of this story, we have to set the atmosphere. You really need to transport yourself. Smell the late 1890s Midwest summer.
Picture the county fairs.
These were colossal events. They were the social and economic hub of the entire region. It was a complete sensory overload.
You've got the smell of livestock mingling with, what, industrial engine oil from the new machines?
Absolutely. Mm. The overwhelming sweetness of spun sugar, the rhythmic clanging of these, you know, very rudimentary rides.
And just the loud, cheerful chaos of 1,000 conversations happening all at once under a beating sun.
It's hot, it's dusty, and everyone is operating at this peak level of excitement because for many of these towns, this is the highlight of the entire summer season.
And it's into that intensely natural, you know, chaotic environment that the sources introduce a figure whose appearance is immediately jarring.
Jarring is the perfect word. It's too theatrical, too deliberate.
And fundamentally too clean. Oh. Too clean for the rough and tumble setting of a dusty fairground. It just doesn't fit.
So our story begins with this central figure, the man described in the sources only as Ronald McDonald, the Drifter.
A drifter?
Yes. A professional itinerant performer. He's operating on the margins of the established carnival circuit, moving very systematically from town to town.
So he's shadowing the major fair routes throughout the late 1890s summer. This is a planned campaign.
It seems to be. But and the physical description captured in these fragmented accounts that we have, it's absolutely crucial for understanding the immediate psychological impact he had on people.
This was not a traditional, you know, brightly painted fool in oversized clothes. That's not what we're talking about here.
No, not at all. The sources specify he wore a dark red suit.
And that distinction feels so important.
It's vital. It's not the cheerful primary fire engine red that we know today. This is described as a deep, heavy, possibly ominous shade.
It suggests age, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the color of dried material, or just a complete lack of lightheartedness.
Yes, and it was paired with black waistcoat and stark white gloves.
It's a formalized, almost severe color palette. It speaks of intentional design.
It absolutely does. It makes him stand out,
yeah,
but not in a friendly way. It's more like the uniform of a serious performance.
Almost military in its precision.
That's a great way to put it. It's deliberately contrasting with the chaotic, ragtag nature of the typical fair worker you'd see walking around.
So he's visually demanding attention, yes, but through a kind of unsettling theatricality. This attire suggests his performance was serious, maybe ritualistic.
And removed from the casual spontaneity of the surrounding carnival atmosphere, he was an island of strange formality in a sea of chaos.
But the defining detail, the one that makes this original description so genuinely horrifying, was the smile.
Ah, yes, the smile.
It wasn't simple grease paint applied to his mouth. The sources describe a painted smile that was so wide and so fixed that it literally cut into his cheeks.
And that just elevates the description far beyond simple clown makeup. Think about the physiological implications of that claim.
Say awful.
It suggests a deeply committed, perhaps surgically or mutilatingly enhanced commitment to a permanent state of forced joy.
It's the uncanny valley effect amplified to its maximum level of discomfort.
He wasn't just performing happiness. He was wearing a fixed mask of aggressive, artificial euphoria that transgressed the actual boundaries of a human face.
And this fixed, non-natural smile is the core visual mechanism of the Drifters.
Yeah.
Well, of his brand.
It is. It's the visual trauma. It's the element that makes him unforgettable. It transforms him instantly from just a quirky entertainer into a figure of pure psychological dissonance.
And this man, this figure, he operated a specific venue for his show. He wasn't barking from a stage or walking through the crowds.
No, he ran a closed, specific tent. And he gave it a name that, in retrospect, is just terrifying in its banality.
He called it the Happy Meal Tent.
The Happy Meal Tent. The inherent irony of that name, even in the late 19th century, it suggests a prepackaged, standardized commodity of comfort.
A Happy Meal, even then, it suggests a complete unit of satisfaction, a transaction designed to deliver a guaranteed outcome.
And this Drifter was systemizing a terrifying routine under a completely benign, consumer-friendly label. It's genius in a horrible way.
And his marketing strategy was ruthlessly effective, precisely because it subverted any parental suspicion.
That's the key. The sources highlight that admission was free for children.
Which, at a county fair where everything costs money, where parents are constantly counting pennies, a free attraction for the kids is a massive draw.
It minimizes the immediate alarm bells that might otherwise sound. It's a perfect lure.
It made the tent hyper accessible. So parents would, drop their children off, relieved to have a moment of respite, and the kids occupied.
Exactly. They'd see nothing but a charitable or maybe a clever business model. They failed to account for the specific targeted nature of the offering.
And we also need to appreciate the sheer prevalence of this figure. The sources emphasize he wasn't a local anomaly. This wasn't a one-and-done event.
No, this Drifter systematically toured multiple towns. He was maximizing his reach across the entire Midwest fair circuit over the course of that summer.
He was efficient, mobile, and organized in this terrifying operation.
Let's return to the sensory experience for a moment, because this is where the unnatural nature of the Drifter's presence really manifests.
Right, the smells of the fairground, you've got popcorn, dust, fried dough. They're comforting, familiar signals of enjoyment.
But the sources highlight a unique, almost chemical atmosphere that surrounded the Happy Meal tent.
That's right. The immediate vicinity of the tent, unlike the neighboring booths selling hot dogs or caramel corn, carried the smell of red paint.
In the context of a food service or a children's entertainment venue, that is a jarring, immediate clue that something is fundamentally wrong.
You shouldn't smell industrial pigment, fresh lacquer, or theatrical coating at a place that's promising a meal.
It immediately sets the tent apart as a space of performance and artifice. It suggests costume maintenance, prop construction.
And maybe a preparation process that had nothing to do with food safety or natural ingredients?
It creates an immediate sense of unease. Ronald McDonald was meticulously curating a performance space defined by this artifice, the fixed, unnatural smile, the stylized attire.
All underscored by the chemical scent of his own highly controlled professional presentation.
That red paint smell is the branding signature of the original operation. And it serves as the first subtle alarm that, according to the legend, parents completely ignored.
Okay, so let's follow the sources and step inside the Happy Meal tent. If the exterior was unsettling because of the smell of paint and the Drifter's jarring look,
the interior descriptions provided in the material just confirm a highly controlled, manipulative psychological environment.
The internal setting was designed to limit perception. The light was universally described as dim.
And that's crucial. Dim light obscures the faces of others. It prevents children from seeing their peers clearly.
And most importantly, it prevents any real scrutiny of the man himself, or the contents of the package, or even the structure of the tent.
It creates mystique, sure. But functionally, it obscures potential evidence. It's a controlled environment.
And once you're inside, the olfactory details, they just deepen the psychological puzzle. The sources state the air inside smelled of sweet bread and varnish.
Now, this combination is the linchpin of the whole operation's psychological structure. Sweet bread. That implies fresh baking, comfort, maternal association, Nourishment.
It's the classic scent of hospitality and safety. It's the lure.
It's the lure. But varnish. Varnish is a chemical. It's often used for treating wood, preserving materials, or as an element in paint or lacquer.
It's an artificial finishing agent.
So you have the smell of comfort mixed directly with the smell of chemicals and artificial preservation.
It implies that the food preparation, this natural act of nourishment, was fundamentally infiltrated by the artificial, the chemical.
Or the tools of artifice. Specifically, the carving and preservation of the wooden toys mentioned in the contents, or perhaps a component of the meal itself.
It's the immediate primal juxtaposition of safety and danger, all in one breath.
And the experience inside was highly standardized. It was repetitive. Each child received a specific package handed out by Ronald McDonald in that methodical, unsmiling, yet fixed smiling manner.
And we get an astonishing description of the package itself, a description that essentially defines the future of global corporate branding.
The container was a small paper box.
A red paper box, specifically, with a yellow emblem rushed on the side.
There it is.
This is the absolute horrifying foundation of the enduring color scheme. The visual contrast is immediate, recognizable, and highly effective for drawing a child's attention.
And the source suggests the emblem was rushed, which implies a quick mass production approach to this specific iconic packaging. He was churning them out.
The contents were listed as a soft bun, a slice of cold meat, and a hand-carved wooden toy.
The selection is simple, but it's very strategic. The bun and cold meat suggest quick, simple sustenance, easy to prepare in bulk, transport, and distribute without needing heat or complex logistics.
But the hand-carved wooden toy? That adds this element of personalization and effort. This isn't a cheap, stamped piece of tin.
No, a hand-carved item implies significant time investment. It makes it a tangible, individualized artifact given in this systematic exchange.
It's a powerful material keepsake that anchors the memory of the encounter. It makes it feel special, personal.
And then the final element, a small card placed inside the box. It simply read, "Eat up, come back tomorrow."
The chilling casualness of that instruction, that's where the conditioning begins.
It's not an invitation. It's not even a suggestion to enjoy the fare.
It is a subtle yet explicit command for consumption and a demand for continuity.
It's a promise that the experience isn't over and that compliance is expected. It sets up a serial engagement model.
Suggesting that the goal was not a one-time transaction, but systematic daily return visits. He wanted them back.
This command, presented right next to the item of nourishment and the keepsake toy, it just solidifies the transaction. Consume what I give you, internalize the experience, and return for the next step.
And this leads us to the critical point of discrepancy in the sources, the difference between the parental perception and the children's reality.
Yes, parents explicitly stated they saw nothing wrong.
They saw a free treat, simple food, and a man in a silly, if stylized, costume. Their focus was purely on the beneficial transaction. They got a break.
But the children who emerged from that dim tent presented an immediate, dramatic psychological shift.
They stepped out pale and silent.
This is the instant manifestation of profound psychological shock. This isn't just a kid being tired or cranky from a long day at the fair.
No, this was something else entirely. The behavioral changes detailed in the sources were acute and trauma-like. Some children refused to eat for days afterwards.
A sudden, deep aversion to nourishment itself.
Others stopped speaking at all, exhibiting symptoms that today we would recognize as selective mutism.
The uniformity and severity of these post-encounter symptoms, the pallor, the mutism, the aversion to food, it suggests a profound psychological event or some deep-seated conditioning occurred inside that tent.
If we analyze the source's narrative structure, the trauma is linked directly to the consumption and the environment defined by that chemical scent and the fixed smile.
The children came out appearing, well, violated, even if the parents couldn't see the specific mechanism of that violation.
The narrative suggests that the transaction of the Happy Meal somehow corrupted the natural act of eating and speaking.
They internalized something terrifying. And their bodies reacted by refusing the very sustenance that was offered as a lure. It's a complete rejection of the premise.
And this terrifying summer, it reached its dark, cumulative climax with the missing persons reports.
As the drifter moved from town to town, the local authorities eventually started connecting the dots across regional jurisdictions. It took time.
The sources confirm that by the end of that specific fair circuit,
6.16 children had vanished.
16.
16 children disappeared from multiple towns, tracing the exact geographical path of Ronald McDonald the Drifter and his Happy Meal temp.
And this count, 16, is the central tragic anchor of the entire legend. It's a specific, horrifying number.
Law enforcement eventually managed to track down and search the Drifter's wagon, but only after he had vanished.
And what they found, or really the profound absence of what they should have found, is arguably the most chilling piece of forensic data in the entire narrative.
The wagon was found virtually empty.
No sign of the children, no clothing, no evidence of a struggle, and crucially, no large caches of preserved cold meat or any significant food preparation equipment.
Nothing beyond what might be inferred from the scent of sweetbread. The core of his operation was missing.
Instead, they found only the tools of presentation and branding.
A crate of red paint, yellow cloth, and dozens of unused paper boxes.
This requires deep analysis. The lack of traditional evidence forensic trace remains. Tools of struggle. It suggests an absolute professional level of erasure. This was a clean operation.
And the evidence they did find confirms his priority. Branding and systematic performance.
The paint and cloth reinforced the idea that the Drifter's primary concern was maintaining his unique, specific visual identity.
The dark red suit, the yellow emblem on the box. He prioritized the maintenance of the brand over everything else, even basic supplies.
The presence of dozens of unused boxes suggests preparation for the next series of towns, confirming a systematic, ongoing intent. He wasn't planning on stopping.
And the absence of any human trace suggests whatever transpired left no messy physical footprint within the performance space.
It implies a swift, clean operation, possibly conducted elsewhere, or utilizing a mechanism of disposal that authorities in the late 1890s just could not detect or trace.
So the investigation was left with an empty theatrical space and only the raw materials for future performances.
It was a complete victory of presentation over detection. The man, Ronald McDonald the Drifter, had simply executed his final vanishing act.
And the tragedy became a localized, terrifying memory.
And that memory, that systemic trauma, leads us to a necessary point of reflection before we transition to the corporate world.
The erasure was achieved not just by the Drifter's meticulousness, but by the failure of systemic memory across those Midwest towns.
The tragedy of the 16 missing children, immense as it was locally, it just faded into regional folklore. It became a dark, dusty piece of Americana, a ghost story told at campfires.
Until it wasn't.
Now the timeline shifts dramatically. We jump forward approximately 10 years after the height of the disappearances and the Drifter's vanishing act.
The tragedy is now safely categorized as an old, terrible legend, perhaps occasionally whispered about at future fairs, but mostly forgotten by the larger, rapidly modernizing nation.
We leave the dusty, chaotic fairgrounds, and we shift the setting dramatically to the slick, developing advertising and commerce hub of Chicago in the early 20th century.
This is the moment where the legend of the past allegedly collides with the future of global corporate identity.
So you have a Chicago advertising company, and they're tasked with an essential project: designing an unforgettable, iconic mascot for a growing restaurant chain.
They're aggressively searching for visual inspiration. They're looking for images that strike that perfect balance between being attention-grabbing and, you know, consumer-friendly.
And here is the element of pure narrative horror that the sources insist upon, that this company, through a chain of unlikely events, somehow acquired an old fairground poster.
A discarded remnant, maybe retrieved from an antique store or a storage facility. An artifact dating back to the very circuit the Drifter had toured a decade earlier.
And you have to, as a critical listener reviewing this source material, you have to acknowledge how heavily the myth relies on this one specific coincidence.
It's a huge leap. How credible is the idea that a high-level Chicago ad firm acquired a random, decades-old, potentially unique, crime scene-adjacent poster?
It's the essential leap of faith the sources demand you take. The narrative needs this accidental, terrifying moment of rediscovery to function.
And instead of seeing a legend of terror, the designers allegedly saw immediate marketability. They saw a striking, eye-catching image that commanded attention through its unique, fixed theatricality.
They didn't see a monster. They saw potential brand recognition. They saw dollar signs.
And the corporate adoption of this image involved the explicit, intentional preservation and repurposing of the Drifter's core branding elements.
This is the core of the dark mirror analysis. The three specific elements the sources claim were lifted directly from the old poster and incorporated into the modern mascot
are the very elements of performance the Drifter used to manipulate his victims.
Okay, so number one, they kept the name Ronald McDonald.
A simple, catchy, alliterative name. Perfect for mass memorization and global recall. Easy for a kid to say.
Number two, they kept the colors.
The striking, high-visibility primary red and yellow that defined the original Happy Meal box, designed to draw the specific attention of children in a crowded visual environment.
And number three, the most important one, they kept the smile.
That wide, theatrical, fixed grin that was initially described as cutting into his cheeks was cleaned up. It was sanitized, brightened, simplified into a symbol of mandatory, unrelenting corporate joy.
But the foundational mechanism of the exaggerated, non-natural smile remained intact. The core idea is still there.
And this is where the legend achieves its ultimate thematic power. The original smile functioned as a fixed, unsettling mask of forced compliance and engagement in the 1890s.
The modern corporate iteration functions similarly. It's a symbol of mandatory, accessible joy that removes all ambiguity about the emotional state required when you're engaging with the brand.
It is a smile that is required, not organic. You must be happier.
The sources are essentially presenting a story of corporate whitewashing, a story of effective visual appropriation.
The uncomfortable details, the dark suit, the chemical smell, the 16 missing children were systematically scrubbed away in the transition from fairground monster to global brand icon.
The drifter vanished, the evidence was sparse, and the poster was simply categorized as an anonymous piece of Americana to be used for inspiration.
The horror was reduced to an aesthetic choice, a font, a color palette.
If we connect this to the broader historical critique of branding and myth, especially looking at some of the other dark origins mentioned in the index,
Things like the Klaus Richter story or the real Wendy legend.
it highlights how identities can be completely deleted from history, yet their defining characteristics survive the passage of time. They're just rebranded and optimized for consumption.
So the very things that make the mascot recognizable today, the name, the colors, the fixed smile, are, according to this unnerving legend, the precise, highly effective elements of performance the Drifter relied upon.
It's a perfect, terrifying example of how marketing can triumph over the memory of tragedy. It just paves right over it.
So it raises an important question for you, the listener. When you look at that globally ubiquitous grin, are you truly seeing a symbol of comfort?
Or, as the sources claim, are you seeing an efficient echo of a killer's meticulously crafted, manipulative brand identity?
Comfort and familiarity that the modern icon provides relies entirely on the successful erasure of the darkness inherent in its design DNA.
The brand is successful because we have forgotten its alleged source material. We've been taught to forget.
And that transition from the sweet bread and varnish scent of the 1890s tent
To the smell of hot frying oil in the 20th century, it's seamless. But the psychological mechanism of mandatory consumption and systemic conditioning, according to the sources.
it remains fundamentally the same.
The drifter wanted children to eat up, come back tomorrow.
The modern company wants precisely the same thing, just on a global scale. The command for serial engagement has simply been scaled up and sanitized for mass appeal.
And the fact that the sources detail such uniform trauma-like symptoms in the children who emerged from that tent,
The mutism, the refusal to eat.
it suggests that the drifter's operation was highly sophisticated. It was targeting psychological vulnerability in children.
The modern equivalent, while obviously nonviolent, relies equally on targeting early psychological pathways to establish lifelong brand loyalty.
The parallels in methodology are frankly chilling when you lay them out side by side like this.
So we encourage you to reflect on this idea that the power of our cultural icons often lies not in their true benign origins, but in the efficiency of the myth that they replace.
The deeper the historical hole they fill, the more robust the icon becomes.
So we have taken this deep dive from the chaotic, dusty county fairs of the late 1890s all the way to the slick, deliberate advertising agencies of early 20th century Chicago.
And the longevity of the original brand identity is the central lesson here, isn't it?
It is the name Ronald McDonald, the color scheme, red and yellow, and that uncanny, fixed smile all survive the leap from a devastating regional legend into a global icon of childhood consumption.
Fundamentally unchanged in their basic design intent to command attention and demand compliance.
It's a remarkable narrative of cultural transformation, where the unsettling chemical scent of red paint was successfully replaced by the cheerful but equally pervasive scent of commercialized food.
And that leads us to our final provocative thought for you, the listener. We saw a brief note in our source index referencing another legend, one known as the Collector.
Right, tied to the origins of the Monopoly board game, where the entire structure is allegedly designed for psychological training before it offers any reward.
So, if an alleged killer's image can be so successfully repurposed and cleaned up into a symbol of mandatory childhood comfort and consumerism,
what other dark roots might be operating just beneath the surface of the icons we recognize and interact with every single day?
Are these mascots truly comforting symbols of familiarity, or are they carefully constructed historical overlays?
Designed with such visual efficiency that we are simply trained to forget the true origins of their persuasive power.
It's a profound question about the power of myth, the vulnerability of public memory, and the mechanics of corporate erasure.
Keep digging beneath the surface of what you think you know.
You can find more information about these eerie origin stories and the Inspector Story series that cataloged this fascinating legend and others like it by following the link in the description below.
Until next time, question the familiar.
Full story and more eerie origins at Inspector Story.